Gopi Janabalaba Girivaradari Gopi Janabalaba Girivaradari Yasodanandana Braja Janaranjana Yasodanandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tiravanachari Yamuna Tiravanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Balaba Girivara Dari Gopi Jana Balaba Girivara Dari Yasodanandana Braja Janaranjana Jasodanandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tiravanachari Yamuna Tiravanachari Jai Om Vishnupad, Paramahamsa, Parivrajakacharya, Asatara Satashri, Shimadis, Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, Swami Maharaj, Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Jai.
ISKCON Founder, Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shiko Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudeva Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navajit Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamai Jumuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Vujale. Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve. Gauravani Pracharane. Nirvase Sisanivani Paskatyade Satarne. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Scha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa Chubhischa Kupasindaviyeva Chapatitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevi Namo Maha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. January 15th, 2018, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 28, Kapila's Instructions on the Execution of Devotional Service, Text 22. Yachchancha Nisritcha Sarit Prabho. Yachchancha nisritcha sarit paro dakena. Tirtena murjyanti kritena shiva shivo bhut. Jaturmana Shamala Shaila Nishtricha Vrajam.
Jaturmana Shamala Shaila Nishtricha Vrajam.
Jayat Chiram Bhagavatas Charanaravindam. Yet.
Yet.
The Lord's lotus feet.
The Lord's lotus feet.
Lotus feet.
Socha.
Socha.
Washing. Nishricha. Gone forth. Sarit Pavara. Of the Ganges. Udakena. By the water. Tirtena. Holy. Murjni. On his head. Adi Kritena. Born. That's B-R-N-E, like to carry. Shivaha. Lord Shiva. Shivaha. Auspicious. Adbhut. Became. Jatuhu. Of the meditator. Manaha. In the mind. Shamala Shaila. The mountain of sin. Nisrishya. Hurled. Vajram. Thunderbolt. Jayet. One should meditate. Chiram. For a long time. Bhagavata. Of the Lord. Charana Aravindam. On the lotus feet. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The blessed Lord Shiva becomes all the more blessed by bearing on his head the holy waters of the Ganges, which has its source in the water that washed the Lord's lotus feet. The Lord's feet act like thunderbolts hurled to shatter the mountain of sin stored in the mind of the meditating devotee. One should therefore meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord for a long time. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In this verse, the position of Lord Shiva is specifically mentioned. The impersonalist suggests that the Absolute Truth has no form, and that one can therefore equally imagine the form of Vishnu or Lord Shiva or the goddess Durga or their son Ganesh. But actually, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Supreme Master of everyone. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi 5, 142, it is stated, Ekale Ishwara Krishna Arasabha Britya. The Supreme Lord is Krishna, and everyone else, including Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, not to mention other demigods, is a servant of Krishna. The same principles described here. Lord Shiva is important because he is holding on his head the holy Ganges water, which has its origin in the foot wash of Lord Vishnu. In the Hari Bhakti Vilasa by Sanatana Goswami, it is said that anyone who puts the Supreme Lord and the demigods, including Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, on the same level, at once becomes a pasandi, or atheist. We should never consider that the Supreme Lord Vishnu and the demigods are on an equal footing. Another significant point of this verse is that the mind of the conditioned soul, on account of its association with the material energy from time immemorial, contains heaps of dirt in the form of desires to lord it over material nature. This dirt is like a mountain, but a mountain can be shattered when hit by a thunderbolt. Meditating on the lotus feet of the Lord acts like a thunderbolt on the mountain of dirt in the mind of a yogi. If a yogi wants to shatter the mountain of dirt in his mind, he should concentrate on the lotus feet of the Lord and not imagine something void or impersonal. Because the dirt has accumulated like a solid mountain, one must meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord for quite a long time. For one who is accustomed to thinking of the lotus feet of the Lord constantly, however, it is a different matter. The devotees are so fixed on the lotus feet of the Lord that they do not think of anything else. Those who practice the yoga system must meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord for a long time after following the regulative principles and thereby controlling the senses. It is specifically mentioned here, Bhagavatas Charanaravindam, one has to think of the lotus feet of the Lord. The Mayavadis imagine that one can think of the lotus feet of Lord Shiva or Lord Brahma or the goddess Durga to achieve liberation, but this is not so. Bhagavata is specifically mentioned. Bhagavata means, quote, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu, unquote, and no one else. Another significant phrase in this verse is Shiva ha Shivo Bhut. By his constitutional position, Lord Shiva is always great and auspicious. But since he has accepted on his head the Ganges water, which emanated from the lotus feet of the Lord, he has become even more auspicious and important. The stress is on the lotus feet of the Lord. A relationship with the lotus feet of the Lord can even enhance the importance of Lord Shiva. What to speak of other ordinary living entities? Yachosa Nishritya Sarit Pravodakena Tirtena Murjandi Kritena Shiva Shiva Bhut Jatur Mana Shamala Shaila Nishritchivrajam Jachchech Chiram Bhagavatam Charanaravindam. The blessed Lord Shiva becomes all the more blessed by bearing on his head the holy waters of the Ganges, which has its source in the water that washed the Lord's lotus feet. The Lord's feet act like thunderbolts, hurled to shatter the mountain of sin stored in the mind of the meditating devotee. One should therefore meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord for a long time. So we may be very surprised that here the lotus feet of the Lord, Charana Aravinda, Aravinda, lotus, are compared to a vajram or a thunderbolt. So why would you compare a lotus to a thunderbolt? We have this metaphor and simile of lotus being used to describe the Lord in so many places. It's probably the most common metaphor or simile that's used to describe the Lord in general. Lotus eyes, lotus hands. Kunti is talking about, you know, all the parts of the Lord are like a lotus, lotus feet. And I think for those of us who grew up in places where lotuses were not very common, it might have seemed a little, it was a little bit of a culture change at first. You know, in America, we have water lilies, of course, in plenty, but not so much lotuses. And in America, and I think in Europe also, the main flower that's associated with beauty and fragrance and softness is the rose, not the lotus. So we would have said his rose feet, his rose hands. I like that. But the lotus is there because it is very beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful flowers. I mean, in general, we associate beauty with flowers, birds. It's one of the most beautiful flowers, and it also has a very nice fragrance, and it's very soft. So those three things. And, of course, generally, people's feet are not like that. Generally, people's feet are not soft. Generally, people's feet become calloused in order to walk. Generally, people's feet don't smell that nice. And generally, people's feet are not that attractive. It's not, feet are not considered one of the more attractive features of a body, usually. Usually. But with Krishna, his body and himself is the same, and all of his parts are equal to the whole, and all are fully beautiful and fully fragrant, and particularly fully soft. So a thunderbolt, as Prabhupada usually translates it, or lightning flash, it doesn't have those same qualities. So I suppose one could say that a flash of lightning in the sky has some sort of beauty, but it's not really, it's not what you would call beautiful. It's frightening. And it certainly isn't fragrant. Thunderbolts, lightning, it's not. It's no fragrance. And it most certainly is not soft. It's anything but soft. It's extremely hard. And of course, this combination of the flower and the thunderbolt, in which case, generally it is a rose rather than a lotus. And Prabhupada talks about how the guru is as soft as a rose and as hard as a thunderbolt. And the same is true of the Lord, that the Lord is as soft as a lotus or a rose, and also as hard as a thunderbolt. Now, we might generally think that this hard as a thunderbolt applies only to the demons, and the soft as a rose or as a lotus applies only to the devotees, just like Vishnu in his four hands. He has the lotus and the conch for the devotees and the club and the disc for the demons. But I think all of us who are, at least speaking for myself, I'm trying to be a devotee, we have experienced also harshness from Krishna. We've experienced not only softness, so we experience things from Krishna that, and from Guru that are very soft and that are very, you take a flower like a rose or a lotus and you want to touch it, you want to smell it, you want to, Prabhupada would take jasmine and sleep with them on his pillow. You take a flower like that and you want to hold it up to your face again and again and again for the smell, for the texture. You want to play with the petals. You want to interact with it. You want to look at it. You want to smell it. You want to touch it over and over again. And with a thunderbolt, you want to see it from a distance. You want to admire it from a distance, as the more in fear and wonder rasas, bhaya and adbhuta ras. But you certainly don't want to cuddle with the thunderbolt. You want to take your thunderbolt and put it up against your nose and your cheek and put it on your pillow. And so you want to get away. You want to admire it from a safe distance. You want to get away from it. I'm thinking about when Arjuna saw the universal form, and he was also, okay, show me your other form. I can't maintain myself. And many times our dealings with Krishna are also like that. So I remember one devotee some years ago who contacted me and said that his spiritual life had become very dry. So we were chatting for a while, and in the course of our discussion, he mentioned that he had prayed to Krishna, please go easy with me, take things slowly, don't push me too hard. And I said, well, that's probably a reason things have become dry. That, you didn't want the thunderbolt, you only wanted the rose, so to speak. You didn't want the other aspect. And when we're experiencing that thunderbolt of the Lord, and we all experience it in different ways, and we may think that the Lord is cruel and harsh. I mean, Vajra also means a diamond, something very sharp. And of course, a thunderbolt's very dangerous. So we may think that he's being cruel to us. Here it's smashing. Shamala Shaila. Shaila, of course, means a stone, something that's very hard. And it's not easy to break up a stone. You need some heavy-duty tools. It can be broken up very, very gradually, of course, with water, which is very soft. But if it's going to be broken up quickly, then something like a lightning bolt would be very efficacious. Of course, it is interesting that although most of us have some objection, whether or not we voice it, but most of us have some objection when the Lord deals with us like a thunderbolt, then we turn around and we say, I want to advance quickly in Krishna consciousness. Like that devotee who was, Krishna goes slowly, but make everything sweet. So we want the results of Krishna consciousness as quickly as possible, like in George Harrison's song, I want to show you it won't take long. But then we don't want the thunderbolt. We want the Lord to be more like water that's just pouring on this rock of our heart Very, very slowly. So how do we understand that the Lord is a thunderbolt lotus? A thunderbolt lotus. What, in as a literary ornament, that would be an oxymoron, like icy hot, right? So to understand this, we want to look at what is required. Why do the lotus feet become like a thunderbolt? What's the issue here where the thunderbolt is still actually a lotus? So the first thing we're going to look at is this Shamala Shaila, and then the nature of Krishna's feet, and then how we connect with those feet through practice and imperfection, which Prabhupada talks about in this purport. So we have a problem. And one devotee wrote me a few days ago, someone who listens to this class, wrote me about the story I told of the devotee who was drowning in the Ganga and remembered a chewing gum song from an advertisement instead of the Hare Krishna mantra, and asked, how is that possible when we all want Krishna consciousness? Well, we have a problem, and it's a problem that we're aware of in terms of its symptoms, but we're not so aware of what the problem actually is, because we don't want to be aware of what the problem actually is. And that is that we're full of a desire to lord over the material nature. We're full, actually, icha dvesha, of desires and hatred, dvesha, envy. We have a deep-seated hatred and envy of God, that we don't like how he runs things. In fact, our objection to the Lord's thunderbolt dealings with us are predicated on this envy. That if I were God, I wouldn't deal with me like this. So if he's dealing with me like this, there must be something wrong with him. You know, I could do a better job. I could do a much better job of being my own God. You know, I mean, if I were my own God, I would have written the script of my life differently. Oops, I did write the script of my life through my karma. Oh, well, we'll just put that aside. So, you know, if I were God, I would write the script of the world differently. I'd certainly write my own script differently. I would write the script of the people that I love differently. I'd write the script of the world differently. I would do a much better job. I don't like the way he's doing things. I want to be the controller. I would have different universal laws. At least they'd be different for me, you know. I'd be able to do sinful activity and not have to suffer a reaction. You know, I'd be above the law, like God is above the law. God can dance with the gopis and shoot Bali from behind a tree and he doesn't suffer a reaction. So that it would be like that for me. I'd be the exception. I mean, I might have the laws of karma for other people, I don't know. But certainly not for myself, and I would administer the universe quite differently. So that's a problem. It's a problem. Because, as I said, we have written the script for our lives through our karma, so obviously I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm obviously a fool. I'm obviously incompetent. Because I don't know about everyone listening to this class, but I can tell you frankly that I'm not exactly happy with all of the external aspects of my life. I wish that they were different. But I'm the one who created them. You know, it's like I wrote the book. I don't like my own book. So such is the proof that I would really make a lousy God. I think that's pretty evident. But this desire to be God, this envy, why is he God? And this envy shows up in our criticism, particularly of people who have some sort of power or authority over us. Criticism, you know, of the children of the parents, the wife to the husband, the employees to the employer, the citizens to the government. There's a general tendency to want to find fault in anybody who has greater power than we do. And this is all envy. And this envy causes us to sin. You know, Prabhupada's translating this, the mountain of sin. So what does sin mean? And people may think, well, God has a bunch of rules, and these rules are kind of whimsical, I suppose. And the rules that God has seems to tamper down our enjoyment a bit, you know. Just like when Prabhupada's godbrothers went to England and said, okay, you want to be a Brahmin, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling, and Lord Jetland said, well, how would we live? So we think, you know, especially illicit sex and intoxication, but even meat eating and gambling, I mean, there's a lot of people, I know a lot of people who struggle with trying to be vegetarian for years. You know, but I like eating chicken or something, you know. So they think God has these rules, this simply to make me miserable. And that sin means, you know, sin means getting sneaking and getting some enjoyment that I'm not allowed to get. But what sin actually means is anything that's not in accord with truth. If we're honest, we'll say that anything considered sinful is something that's not in accord with the way the universe works, the way matter works, the way our bodies work, the way our mind works. It's something that's out of harmony. It's like if you had a symphony orchestra and one of the musicians played out of harmony. That would be a sin. It's something that would be causing distress because it's not right. You know, or if you take some gadget or some machine and you try to force a part of it to work in a way it's not intended to work and generally break it because it's not in harmony with truth. So sin is very simple. It's something that's false. It's something that's not real. It's using things in a way that's not real. And this tendency to sin comes from this original envy of God, which is also not real. It's just not real. I wouldn't be a better God than God. I prove that every day by my foolish decisions. It's not true. There is nothing I can do that I would be a better God than God. And all my actions based on that are also of the nature of falsity. And anything that's not in accord with truth causes suffering. I mean, the example I give all the time, it's a very simple example, is you have a room that has a door, and if you walk through the door, you're happy, and if you try to walk through the wall, you're unhappy. And it's not that the architect, you know, or the builder, or the government inspectors, they didn't design walls to make people unhappy. They didn't say, well, let's put a wall here so people will walk into it and get bruises on their forehead. No, they put a wall there to hold up the building or to demarcate spaces. So if you use a wall like a door, you suffer. Now, if you use a door like a wall, you suffer too. You're leaning against it, somebody opens it, and you fall down. So one has to use things in accord with truth. And that's what sin is. So we have this mountain of sin in our hearts like a rock. It's like a rock, this desire, this envy, this hatred, that I am going to do things how I want to do them, even though I've never been happy by doing it. It's intense determination. I'm going to walk into walls and try to stop me. And I'm going to walk into walls and not suffer. I mean, we see this all the time in other people. I'm going to drink alcohol, but I won't get addicted. You know, I'm going to enter into a relationship with this, you know, nasty, abusive person, and I'm not going to suffer. I'm going to be able to deal with it. I was talking to someone recently who's entered into a relationship with somebody who's got a lot of serious problems. And I said, you know, did you know about these problems this person has before you started becoming intimate with them? Well, yeah, but I thought I could handle it. Okay. So that's this rock of sin. I can handle it. I can do it. I'm different. I'm different. I can challenge God. I can challenge the universe. I'm above everything. Ishwaraham aham bhogi siddham. I am perfect, powerful, and happy. I'm great. And this ego of I'm great, I am powerful, I can do what I want. I can break the law. That, it's like a rock. And it's so hard and it's so solid that, you know, we're not even really aware of it motivating our actions. It's such a solid part of us. And it's huge. It's not like a little rock. It's not like a little pebble or something. It's this huge, solid rock mountain. Well, that's a problem. It's a problem if you want to be happy. Because one can't be happy acting against reality. It's a big problem. So here is a very interesting solution. And it's a solution that I think most people in the world would think is rather absurd. Okay, so all of your suffering is due to working out of sync with reality. Okay, I think if it's presented that way, people could accept that. If you say all suffering is working out of sync with reality. We don't work in sync with nature, we don't work in sync with our bodies, with our minds, and with other living beings. And if we could get in sync, if we could be in harmony, then we would be happy. I think the majority of people would agree with that. And the problem is our desire to be out of harmony. Now that people might struggle with a little bit more. They'd say, oh, I want to be in harmony. But we don't. We want to be center stage. So once you understand that the problem, the reason I'm out of harmony is that I want to be out of harmony. I want the enjoyment of being in harmony along with the privilege of being out of harmony. That's the problem. And the solution is to meditate on someone's feet. Meditate. Jayat. To be completely absorbed. Jayat chiram. To be completely absorbed in someone's feet. You know, sometimes I think about what people unfamiliar with Krishna consciousness would think when they visit one of our temples or contact us. Now, there's one temple where they have a huge painting in the temple. They have lots of paintings, so it's one of many, but they have one of Krishna cutting off Shishupal's head, this, you know, person in the process of getting decapitated. And both myself and Giriraj Swami in that temple said, you know, you really should change this picture, but they haven't. And there's another temple. Again, they have a number of paintings, but when you walk in the temple room door, right smack in front of you is this painting of Balaram raising, you know, with red-hot, angry eyes, like big eyes, you know, picking up his plow and threatening Yamuna, who's on her knees with hands folded. And I said, you know, this is not a very good painting for people unfamiliar with the tradition. You see some man threatening harm to a supplicating woman. You know, how do people see things? So in a similar way, or one of the funniest perhaps was in one temple they had the verse Harinama Harinama Eva Kevalam without diacritics. They had it written not phonetically. Had it written with Roman letters that would normally have diacritics, but without diacritics, and they had it in a huge banner, huge, each letter like a foot high, up over the altar. And I looked at it, and I said, oh, that says, Nasty Eva, Nasty Eva, Nasty Eva. I said, some guest is going to walk in, and like, who's this Lady Eva, and why is she so nasty, and why are you guys meditating on that she's so nasty? So, you know, the same with this feet thing. People come and like, what's with you guys and feet? And we have paintings of feet, and we're always talking about feet. So imagine just, you know, getting up on the world stage as some big person in the world and saying, the problems to all of them, the solution to all the problems in the world is to be totally absorbed in Krishna's feet. It's like, what? Feet? So why feet? Well, the feet are considered not so nice, you know. They're on the ground, especially if you're walking barefoot. But if you're in a tropical country, even if you have sandals, so your feet are getting pretty dirty. They're contacting the dirt from the road, which is mixed with all kinds of bits and of things. And they're not clean. In many societies, you know, people take off their shoes before they enter, and they also wash their feet. You know, especially in the hotter countries where people travel barefoot or just with open sandals. So the traditional thing, any guest who comes, I mean, in ISKCON, we consider foot washing something reserved for people of very high positions. We consider it a symbol of saintliness. We have all kinds of restriction ISKCON laws about who can wash whose feet who, where, under what situations. But it used to be just, you know, any guest who came to your house. You come to your own house, you wash your feet. Any guest who comes. The Muslims, before they enter their temple, they always wash their feet. In some of our temple, Vishnu temples, Shiva temples, like in Tirupati, there's a provision for washing the feet. So generally, you're not so much into somebody's feet. And being into Krishna's feet shows a lot of humility and respect. Especially if you put your head on someone's feet. That's very symbolic of submission. And just even geographically, you know, the feet are at the bottom, the head is at the top. And for many reasons we associate up or top with better and down or lower with worse. So we have some conception of the feet being a lower part of the body, a dirty part of the body. So if you meditate on someone's feet, it shows an incredible amount of respect. And of course with Krishna there is no difference, high or lower. And meditating on Krishna's feet is also symbolically saying that every part of Krishna's body, Angani Yasya Sakalendriya Vrittimanti, Pasyanti Panti Kalayanti Chiram Chanti, Ananda Chinmaya Sarudvala Vigrahasya, every part of Krishna's body is equally holy. So it's a measure of submission and also a symbolic act of saying that every part of his body is equally holy. And particularly one bows at the feet if one is an offender. And this rock of sin is really our offense to the Lord. And so one meditates on the lotus feet of the Lord as a very concrete, symbolic gesture of apology. It's a way of showing apology. Also, you know, when you lie at someone's feet, they can kick you. They can step on you. So it's on a practical level also, it's a way of submission. And Prabhupada makes the point very clearly here that it has to be Krishna. It can't be somebody else. So why does it have to be Krishna? Because our offense is to Krishna. Once we offend Krishna, we offend so many other people. Mamayvamso jivaloke jivabhuta sanatana. You know, all the living entities, we offend, they're part of Krishna. And so when we offend a living entity, we're really offending Krishna. But our ultimate offense is against Krishna. When I want to be the center, when I want to be the controller, when I want to be the enjoyer. I mean, we know how we feel when we're doing something and someone says, hey, I could do that better, move out of the way. It's disrespectful. Especially if we're trying to help them. So only Krishna's feet. Of course, one may ask, and this is a very side point, one may ask the very legitimate question, well, what about the feet of the devotees? Can't we also meditate on the feet of the devotees? In fact, we're told that if we meditate on Krishna, you know, Krishna says, one who says he's my devotee is not my devotee. One who says he's the devotee of my devotee is my devotee. And we have all these songs about the lotus feet of the guru. It's not Shiva and Brahma gurus. Prabhupada says not Shiva or Brahma. Brahma is our guru. He's the original guru in our line. Lord Shiva also has a sampradaya. The answer to that is very simple, and that is that, yes, indeed, one can and should meditate on the lotus feet of guru, meditate on the lotus feet of Vaishnavas, as Vaishnavas. That's the point. That's the point. So if one meditates on the lotus feet of Vaishnavas as if they were equal to God, then that is also an offense. So, and the devotee will not be pleased. You know, if the American ambassador visits Argentina, So the Argentinian government treats the ambassador as if the ambassador were the president himself. At the same time, they do not address the ambassador as Mr. President. So there, and the ambassador doesn't want to be considered the president. That would be very disrespectful on all. And if the president heard that the ambassador was taking the role of president, the president would fire the ambassador. So sakshat hari twena samasta shastir. So we treat the devotee as good as God, and at the same time, as a messenger of God. And the problem here is if one thinks that Shiva and Brahma are independent gods, or Ganesh, or that they're, you know, and they will feel offended if we deal with them like that. Krishna will feel offended, and it will not work. It will actually be the same sort of problem that we think that we can invent our own process. All right, so Krishna's feet breaks this mountain of sin, because as soon as we meditate on Krishna's feet, we reverse the process of ego. We submit. To meditate on the feet is quite a gesture of submission. It's a gesture of that I am subordinate, that I am sorry, that I wish to work in harmony. And it's interesting that when we do that, then the feet act like a thunderbolt. And again, this may surprise us. We're going towards these feet, and they're beautiful, and they're soft, and they're fragrant. And when we actually get fully absorbed in them, they act like a thunderbolt. But the point is that we want a thunderbolt. You're not going to be able to smash a mountain, a hard mountain, with a lotus or a rose. You know, in fact, often when the demons are fighting with Krishna, it's compared that their weapons were just like flowers hitting the side of a mountain. You know, it doesn't do anything. It's not. There's no awareness. The mountain isn't aware. Some flowers fall from the trees on the mountain and hit the mountain. There's no awareness. In fact, it says when Indra was shooting his thunderbolts at Giriraj, Giriraj wasn't aware because Krishna was holding him. Anyway, that's we need some tough love to break this rock. I mean, as I said earlier, it's possible to break it very slowly. Water will break down rock very slowly. Bahunam janmanam mante gyanamam prapadyate. You know, if we want to take many, 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 many lifetimes to have this mountain of ego worn down, well, you know, we can do that. We can tell Krishna, you know, go very slowly, but then klesha dikatarashtesham, it tends to not be so blissful. There's a friend of mine who's been wanting to start his own business for years and years and years, and hesitating. He called me recently and said, "So I've done it." He said, "I think it's like taking off a bandage, you know, a certain..." Sometimes it feels better if you take it off. Just do it. Just take it off. You know, sometimes we have I had a benign tumor, and I was trying to get rid of it slowly, this and that, the other thing. Finally, I just said, just have surgery. You know, I went to the surgeon. Can you just take it out? Now, even an ordinary surgeon, when they're going to take out some tumor, or they're going to remove some problem, they give you an anesthetic. They do it so you're helped and not hurt. They put you in a sterile, you know, environment, and they give you an anesthetic, give you means of dealing with the difficulty. So Krishna also, he's the supreme doctor, and when he uses this thunderbolt, so if we deal with him properly, we'll see that even though he's dealt with this, used a thunderbolt, that it's been for our benefit. And he's actually done it very gently. You may be aware that the main way that plants grow is through nitrogen. Most of the nitrogen on the planet is in the air. And the way that the nitrogen from the air gets into the soil naturally is through lightning. Lightning changes the atoms in the air and puts the nitrogen into the soil. And the nitrogen in the soil makes plants grow. You know, here I am in Hawaii. It's a volcanic island. So the only rock here is igneous rock. Not like, say, New Zealand, which is also a volcanic island, but New Zealand also has part of the ocean floor that's come up, so it's got a combination of kinds of rock. It's got a lot of sedimentary rock. But here in Hawaii, everything is igneous rock. Everything's volcanic rock. And you see the new lava fields are just, it's just lava. It's a lava desert. And then gradually little seeds lodge in the crevices and the plant roots break up the lava and it becomes soil. And, you know, eventually it becomes a forest. I mean, here where we are, it's such a forest, it's hard to keep the vegetation down. So the lightning, it produces this nitrogen in the soil, which allows the plants to grow and break up the rock. And as Ravindra Prabhu said in his outline about japa, you know, that first when our false ego is dismantled, it does feel very painful. It does feel like Krishna's throwing lightning bolts at us and frying us to a crisp. Because our false ego is how we identify ourselves. It's who we are. We feel like somebody is destroying our very self and is going to leave us with nothing. But what happens when the lightning bolt starts to knock off big chunks of this ego? Well, then it starts to be delightful. We start to realize, oh, I've actually lost this great burden of pride and ego. And under all that, I'm a spiritual being. I am, let's probably say, to be free in the light, both as illumination and as lack of weight. I have a soul with full freedom, and my real identity is that Krishna is the Ishwara, and I am the Britya. Ekala Ishwara Krishna. Everyone else, Sarva, is Britya. Everyone else is a servant. It's a wonderful identity. Krishna doesn't break the rock to just leave desolation. He breaks the rock to reveal our real identity under it. Just like sometimes in mining, there's precious metals hidden, you know, inside of a rock. If you've ever seen, even semi-precious, if you've ever seen quartz crystals or amethyst crystals, they're inside of a rock. So even though this process of surrender acts like a thunderbolt, that just means that it's faster. That Krishna gets excited that we're coming to him. As anyone would. If we love somebody who's offended us and then they want to come back, we get excited too. So Krishna gets excited and he wants to speed up the process. And then we find that this thunderbolt is actually lotus feet. We meditate on the lotus feet and they act like a thunderbolt. We're like, whoa! But we find that they have acted like lotus feet. They have acted like soft and sweet and beautiful feet. So how do we do this? We actually meditate on feet. That's what we do. Prabhupada talks about a practice. And he says, here in the purport, he said that those who practice yoga system must meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord for a long time after following the regulative principles and thereby controlling the senses. So Prabhupada's talking about Ashtanga yoga. Yam, niyam, asana, pranayam, pratyahara, and then dhyana, which becomes dhanana, to hold, and finally, of course, samadhi. So we're not going to be able to meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord if we're leading a sinful life and if our senses are uncontrolled. So there is some stricture, Vaidhi, in the beginning. There's some, we don't like the stricture, but there's some stricture. Now, of course, if we're doing pure bhakti, if we're doing uttam bhakti, then even though there's some stricture in the beginning, kevala nandakanda, we're getting some taste and happiness from bhakti all along, unlike in Astanga Yoga, where it's really a matter of determination and will and intellectual conviction for a long time. So we have a big advantage in bhakti that there's a taste and there's some happiness, even for a neophyte. So for us, ironically, the way we get the strength to follow the regulative principles and the way we get the strength to control our senses is by meditating on the lotus feet of the Lord. So in Astanga Yoga, you don't start meditating on the lotus feet of the Lord until you've controlled your senses and followed the regulative principles. But bhakti's not like that. We don't go out on the street on Harinam and say to people, okay, first put down your beer and walk away from your girlfriend and then you can chant Hare Krishna. We say, hey, by chanting Hare Krishna, you're going to want to put down your beer and, you know, stop having your affair with your girlfriend. So we start meditating on Krishna's lotus feet immediately, but we should understand that until we're following the regulative principles and controlling the senses, that our meditation will not be as efficacious. But it's our meditation that's will purify us to make the meditation more efficacious. So as a practice, one is engaging some willfulness. There is some aspect of will here. There is some aspect of, I promise to chant 16 rounds every day. There's some compulsion. I mean, we may take it on ourselves, just like a person gets married and says, I promise to do this. You know, we're not being compelled by somebody outside of ourselves. It's a measure of our free will, but still, there's some compulsion, there's some practice, there's some determination, there's some will. Prabhupada says, a hard struggle with determination. Prabhupada would often use a war metaphors. You know, we're having a war with Maya. But at a certain point, it becomes spontaneous, as Prabhupada also says here in this purport. And then one is naturally meditating on Krishna's feet. So at first, we may, you know, regulate that I have to sit and chant japa, and while I chant japa, I meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord, and we have to, you know, we may have to do that. As Prabhupada said, like George Harrison could be looking at a picture of Krishna while he's chanting. But for the perfected devotee, that's not required. For the perfected devotee, they're naturally thinking of Krishna's lotus feet and Krishna's holy name all of the time, just like anyone who's in love with anyone. And when we do that, when we come to the point that we are always thinking of Krishna's lotus feet, we become aware that there's this huge rock-like mountain in our heart. We become aware that that is the source of our problem. And we genuinely apologize. I wrote a note to someone yesterday and I said, hey, I just found out from someone else that you told me one thing, but you actually did something else, and you really hurt me by lying to me. And the person wrote back, said, I don't want to talk about this. And then also wrote back, well, I'm sorry if you felt hurt, which basically means, you poor idiot for being so sensitive. I said, to say I'm sorry you felt hurt is just insulting the other person. It has to be, I'm sorry I hurt you. So, you know, eventually our meditation on Krishna's lotus feet is not, okay, well, here's some trick where I can figure out how to milk the ecstasy out of the world. But it becomes, well, I'm really sorry. And I want to reestablish my relationship, my loving relationship. And when we do that, then it's like this huge thunderbolt that just crack, bam, slam. And the rock is shattered and our real nature becomes obvious. So I'm leaving for India in a couple days and I have a lot to do. Especially since somebody decided to smash into my car in the Walmart parking lot while I was shopping. So I have a lot of things to take care of before I go. I could have just a very few minutes for questions and discussions.
We are sent somebody to go and apologize and also to clear, like you just did, in my opinion, it probably is important, but please tell me if it's right thinking.
I'm trying to understand what you say. So you're saying that as important for us to apologize to those we've offended is to apologize to those who offended us?
No, to clarify, like, let's say somebody offended me, and I think, okay, I'm not going to go and deal with this. I'm just going to forget it. But in actuality, I didn't do that because...
There's not a rule. It's not a rule. This is one of those, it depends. So, there's many times when people offend us when probably the most intelligent thing to do is to completely forget it and let it go. You know, we're not going to... If we were... I don't know how your life works, but if I were to try to solve all of the times that people did or said things that bothered me on any level, to any extent, it would take up a tremendous amount of my time.
Oh, right. I guess what I'm trying to say, maybe it's in the most important and close relationships. It's very important.
And even then, I think sometimes in the most important close relationships is probably precisely the time when you don't bring up everything. You know, it really depends. We're not going to... We have some desire to have everything in balance and everything in harmony through justice. And that doesn't really work. You know, we're kind of then trying to work through the karmic path. I've done this to you, and therefore I have to fix it. You've done this to me, and therefore you have to fix it. And it's important that everything I've done to you and everything that you do to me gets fixed. But first of all, that's just not possible. At least I haven't seen that it's possible. I'm not able to fix on the external level everything I've done wrong to others. First of all, I don't even know everything I've done wrong to others. And second of all, I don't necessarily know how to fix it. And third of all, they may not accept that it's fixed. I mean, I've had that latter experience where I do everything I can to try to apologize to somebody, etc., and fix it, and then they're just not satisfied. And it works the other way, too. You know, I may not be satisfied. So, and in the course of trying to fix one thing, as Prahlad Maharaj says, the cure is often worse than the disease, in the course of trying to fix one thing, we often mess up something else. And there are so many examples that we can give, in the world, where something that was supposed to be a cure caused another problem. You know, I was talking about fertilizer, that the invention of artificial fertilizer increased food output in the world, but it's messed up the balance in the world, and now half the food of the world is being thrown away. So,
it's not a matter of fixing.
So, but we have to be careful it's not for a matter of fixing. If it's not for a matter of fixing, then what is it for? It's for
the purity of the heart, that not to harbor that, because it's accumulation.
But the purity of the heart, here we're told the purity of the heart is to take shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord and meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord. It's not always that we go to the other jiva and we try to fix things. You know, if I'm going to the other jiva and try to fix things, it better be for Krishna's pleasure and not just to try to make everything balanced, especially if somebody has offended me. The vast majority of the time that somebody offends me, I should do nothing other than take shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord and say, you know, you've allowed this person to offend me. That's your will. You know, may this person not suffer. May it not affect my relationship with them. May I still wish them well, and may I learn from this what you want me to learn. That's mostly what we should do when other people offend us, the vast majority of the time.
Correct. Okay. No, I don't want to take too much time because...
It's an important point. I mean, when do we actually go to a person who's offended us and try to get them to understand how they've offended us so that they will fix things? When do we do that? I mean, one place we do that is when that person is a subordinate. So if that's our child, our disciple, our employee, you know, and it's required the thing. But even then, we don't do it all the time. I mean, if parents corrected their children for everything, that would damage the relationship. There's a lot of things you let go. There's one book on parenting that says major on the majors and minor on the minors. You've got to be able to distinguish between what's something serious that needs to be addressed and what's something minor that you just pretend it didn't even happen. But basically, we can go to people who are our subordinates. And then we can also go if, you know, if we're not able to let it go. But then that's also a fault on our part. And we can say to the person, you know, I really should be able to be Trinada Pisunichena, and I'm trying, and I'm not able to do it. I'm just not able to do it, and I'm sorry. This is a weakness in myself. So with our subordinates, we're trying to rectify them for their benefit, hopefully, not for our ego. Because that's our job. That's our service. We're supposed to be helping them to get better. I mean, actually, we should never, ever, 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 under any circumstances, ask anyone to fix any offense against us. That's the Trinada P principle. Never. We should always leave that in the hands of God. That doesn't mean we stay there and let somebody kick us in the face. You know, and if somebody, you know, if there's some crime, we should report it to the authorities and so forth. We should work within the justice system. I don't mean that. But we should never emotionally take offense from anybody. That's the whole principle of Trinada P. We may take some action, but we don't actually, we should never actually feel that, you know, I'm offended, I'm hurt. We shouldn't harbor that. The feeling may come, but we should let it go. So if we're going to go to someone, it should be someone who's a junior to us, who are supposed to rectify. That's our job. That's our service. We're not going to them because we're offended. We're not going to them because, you know, we want them to fix the situation for our ego. We're going to them because that's our job to help them. And if we go to somebody else where it's not our job to help them, then we should go in our own humility and just say, I really shouldn't be doing this. I really should be enough of a devotee that that I'm not doing this. But I'm not. And it's really, it's eating at me. I haven't been able to deal with it spiritually. I mean, of course, in just ordinary talk, I mean, ordinary dealings with people, you know, we might say, hey, look, you know, when you don't put the milk back in the refrigerator, it spoils and it's left out overnight and we're losing a lot of money on the milk and I'm the one earning the money and I'm really distressed about this. Could you please put the milk away at night? You know, there's practical matters like that that we might say. But that should be a very simple thing. Is that all right? And then Bhakti Sunil here is asking, is typing please accept my humble obeisances, is it as effective as offering obeisances at the senior's feet? Well, we don't just offer obeisances to seniors. Well, it could be if mentally you're falling at their feet when you type it. If you type it, you know, I have a little thing in my email where it's just kind of automatic. I just push a button and it just types that. So I don't think I get much benefit for that at all. I mean, it depends on, you know. It depends what's your mentality. Another question, comment, discussion?
Well, I wanted to take the opportunity to say that we as a group cannot express our appreciation for the classes that you've given, Mataji. We are really, really going to miss you and look forward to the last few classes that you give before you permanently leave Hawaii for India, the Holy Dham. But we really, really are indebted to the wonderful instructions that you've given and the time that you've spent with us. So thank you, thank you.
Well, I'm very indebted that you give me an opportunity to preach because it's the main way that we please Srila Prabhupada, and by pleasing Srila Prabhupada, it's the main way that we achieve everything that we want to achieve. So, thank you for giving me that opportunity. Okay, we could take one more if there's anything else. Okay, well, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.